Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and on this New Year's Day, we revisit some of the guests who elicited the most praise and gratitude from our listeners. We begin with an interview from September the 11th, exploring the paradox that the people who will vote for Donald Trump are the Americans who need government support the most, but want it the least, with many living amidst great industrial pollution, who nevertheless oppose all environmental regulation. Ali Russell Hochschild, one of the most influential sociologists of her generation, joined us to discuss her latest book, Strangers in Their Own Land, Anger and Mourning on the American Right. Over the past 5 years, she embedded herself in Lake Charles, Louisiana, amongst red state supporters of Trump, and went to his rallies to find out why, as liberals often lament, working-class white Americans seem to vote against their own interest, which they are certainly doing, supporting such a manifestly false prophet as Donald Trump, who represents an oligarchical system that has left them at the back of the line. We looked into what the emotional and cultural self-interest is that sustains those that feel alienated and betrayed by their own government, and what can be done to bridge the gap between patronizing liberals and good-hearted folks who are falling victim to a political huckster. Then we'll jump ahead to a program after the election of Donald Trump, broadcast on November the 13th, in which we assessed the extent to which the press can be blamed for helping elect Donald Trump. We spoke with Jeff Jarvis, a professor and director of the Tone Knight Center for Entrepreneurial Journalism at City University, New York, who is a national leader in the development of online news and writes an influential blog, BuzzMachine.com. He joined us to discuss how the media failed to communicate to the public who Donald Trump is, in spite of the overwhelming evidence he provided to make clear how unsuitable he is for the highest office in the land, and how much the false equivalency of so-called balance provided endless coverage of Hillary Clinton's email server, while Trump was able to get away with not releasing his tax returns and thereby not reveal who he's indebted to and who has influence over him. Then finally, we'll replay a broadcast from November the 24th that drew attention to the struggle underway between autocracy and democracy in America as we head into a plutocratic future accelerated by Donald Trump's election. Stephen Schwartz, the editor of the daily web publication SchwartzReport.net and author of The Eight Laws of Change, How to Be an Agent of Personal and Social Transformation, joined us to examine what can be done to reverse the oligarchical takeover of the world, where just 85 families control half of the planet's wealth, a trend that resembles medieval duchies as we face a future controlled by a few families and powerful multinational corporations, with a shrunken middle class of professionals and a vast global underclass. We discuss the grassroots mobilization of opposition to concentrated global power in the hands of a few, and movements towards local control and cooperative engagement of, by, and for the many. And joining us now is Ali Russell Hochschild, who is one of the most influential sociologists of her generation. She's the author of 9 books, including The Second Shift, The Time Bind, The Managed Heart, and The Outsourced Self. 3 of her books have been named as New York Times Notable Books of the Year, and her work appears in 16 languages. The winner of the Ulysses Medal and 5 honorary degrees, as well as Guggenheim and Mellon grants. Her latest book just out is Strangers in Their Own Land, Anger and Mourning on the American Right. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ali Russell Hochschild.
Thank you.
And your book deals with the great American paradox that the people who need government support the most want it the least. And indeed, you know, there have been books written about what's the matter with Kansas, et cetera. Liberals have wrung their hands for decades, wondering why, in their eyes, so many working-class Americans vote against their own interests. But I take it that part of what you've done is sort of explode that kind of liberal bubble and bring texture and meaning to this paradox.
Right. What I've done is to get outside my own enclave here in Berkeley, California, in a Democratic state, and go to an equal and opposite enclave in the South, in Louisiana, which is kind of the super South, and try to take my own alarm system off and really get to know people and see if I could step in their shoes and cross what I call an empathy wall. And on the other side of the wall is a different definition of what an interest is.
Well, just to follow up, though, on the paradox itself, it is pretty clear, is it not, that most of the red states depend more on government spending and are less in the land of free enterprise than the blue states, who, in effect, even though there's this sort of gulf in many ways, it seems like half the country is going back to the 14th century while half of it's moving into the 21st.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's true that the red states are poor. They have worse health, worse education, more dropouts. They don't live as long, and they depend more on the federal government and resist it more. And Louisiana is kind of a super example of the red state paradox, because it's now the poorest state union. It 44% of the state budget comes from the federal government, and they're going for Donald Trump.
And of course, the other paradox is that those who live amidst the great industrial pollution nevertheless dislike all environmental regulation.
That's right.
So that, again, it frustrates liberals, and it's reflected, is it not? I mean, I think a lot of liberals are absolutely having heartburn over the latest CNN poll that has Donald Trump ahead, 45% to 43% among likely voters. So is it possible that the constituency that you've observed is larger than we think?
Yes, it is possible, and more diverse than we think. I mean, you look at the crowds at some of the rallies, and there is this alt-right look. They're angry, mobilized, and you don't see the people who are scratching their heads and feeling ambivalent and voting for, or planning to vote for him anyway, because they don't feel spoken to by anyone else. So that really is a challenge to liberals, I think. Well, wait a minute. What are we missing here, and what are we not understanding? And that's really what drove me to spend this last 5 years interviewing and talking to. I began to think of it as interviewing, but I ended up thinking, they call it visiting. I would do an interview, and they'd say, oh, thanks for the visit. Come again. And so, I think we need to really understand the Trump supporter and see if there aren't crossover issues between left and right that we can focus on.
So when liberals believe that the political right, the working class right, the people that are flocking to Trump's banner have been duped into voting against their economic self-interest, you have discovered that there's something else going on here. That's a kind of patronizing notion, that really it's about what you describe as their emotional self-interest. So
Cultural. Elaborate.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, a lot of them felt as if they were standing in line. Imagine kind of a pilgrimage up a hill, standing in line for the American dream, and you've really worked hard to get your ticket, and the line isn't moving, hasn't been, and then you see people cutting in front of you. Now, who would they be? In their perception, this would be affirmative action women interested in men's jobs, or blacks who were being given any help to get jobs formerly reserved for whites, immigrants, refugees, even public sector workers whose working conditions seem preferable to their own, although much of this is on assumptions, you know, that they make about reality. And then they see President Obama, head of the line, kind of motioning to these people who are cutting ahead, And as if he's their friend, he's trying to help them. And they, that is these right older white Christian group generally, feel like they've been pushed back in line through no fault of their own and have been marginalized. And then they elaborate on that, feel like the whole government is in a way a giant marginalization machine. And they distrust it. And they feel it's not their government. And this is, in a way, in writing the book, I felt like I spent 5 years kind of studying the kindling. And then I went down in March to see Donald Trump the day before the Louisiana primary and the kind of electric response he got. I felt he was the match to that kindling, that they had come to feel strangers in their own land, and he was promising them to reclaim that land. And yeah,
well, he may well do that, well, at least get elected. Whether that fulfills the promise is a huge question, but there's no question that if you ask the you do understand what Donald Trump stands for in the simplistic sense that he's going to make America great again and build a wall. If you ask that same question of a Hillary Clinton supporter, you get a deafening silence because it's not clear what she stands for, even though she's got 1,000 policy positions, all of which are highly expanded upon. And you can, if you can go to the website and spend a few days, you'd learn about just about everything that is important to governance. But that's not counting in a curious way. And how do you think that bubble could be burst in the simple sense that it is a tragedy? On the one hand, these people should not be taken advantage of. They should be listened to and understood.
Right.
But they are being taken advantage of by Donald Trump.
Yes,
there's no question.
I think so.
And
yes,
they're going to be left high and dry. So
right,
how do you somehow make – it doesn't seem like Hillary Clinton's the right person to make that case.
But if she's who we've got.
Exactly.
And,
so what?
Yeah.
How do you proceed?
Okay. I think that you say that, Hillary is offering something, I think, which is unity rather than divisiveness. But what she needs to say is unity includes white, blue-collar men. And, we've thought of, if you're a white man, you're very privileged. But there is a large group in the United States of white men for whom the privilege of manhood and the privilege of whiteness really haven't trickled down. And they're the ones to be that have been forgotten. So I think Hillary needs to reach out to them and also acknowledge some of the pain that has been experienced. I think it's not all sugar and light, and that would help too. But I think the whole glass ceiling, the first woman, that's one thing. But you have to talk about what the ceiling meant and whom it's for. I think I have to speak to the exclusion of whites, actually, without falling into some racist thing.
But privilege itself.
I think that, in other words, I think there's something magical. Just go back to Trump. Magical in his promise. And as you're saying, look, that a lot of people are being set up for a huge fall. I think he's offering, my own interpretation, is a secular version of the rapture, in a sense. That he's, promising that the good will rise up and there'll come a judgment day and that they will be found good. And the people I talked to and really came to know, really pretty extraordinary people, really, felt like their goodness was not seen or acknowledged. They felt very put down by liberals. you know, oh, so-and-so is a redneck and no education and flip-flop shoes. There are a lot of insults that float around rather than a genuine, respectful effort to kind of reach across and see what our common ground really could be. There was quite a lot of common ground, I actually found. A lot of people, and these were super right-wing, you know, want to really diminish the government, who had a kind of friendly feeling about Bernie Sanders. "Oh, Uncle Bernie," they would say. I thought, well, this is interesting. And one guy, Tea Party, said, you know, we really ought to get money out of politics. I told him, well, you have a crossover issue there. But why aren't there conversations going on that make that visible? And, you know, they were agreed on a crossover issue of a reducing prison populations for nonviolent crimes. They were all on board that. And I think we could make a very powerful crossover issue with the environment. At the moment, it's seen as a liberal cause and saving the toad. And many in the South see this as, you know, moral carpetbaggers come in to tell them what to do, and they're very leery of that. But at the same time, environmentally, they are living with a very difficult high pollution situation in Louisiana and would welcome this as a crossover issue.
But when you say, Ali Russell Hochschild, that there's a sense of the end of white privilege in itself has an ugly history with slavery in the South and then Jim Crow. And in many ways, you could make the case that the poor white farmers and blacksmiths that fought for the Confederacy were actually fighting for the plantation owners' right to replace them with slaves. There's always been this lack of sort of understanding or accepting the idea that we have a class system in this country, and in many ways our democracy is being replaced by a plutocracy.
Yes, completely right. And I go into that in Strangers. I looked at the book by the historian Cash, Mind of the South, and he traces the experience of the ancestors of a lot of the people I talked to were poor whites. And when the plantation system came, they were pushed to the marginal lands. And even when the plantation system, you know, moved to other states, they took up the good land, and the plantation owners didn't need white labor because they had slave labor. So these people were kind of in marginal lands and living off the grid with what they could grow. But even the good forests were cut down. So, you know, they've got a history. And the paradox and the sad part is that given that history of rich landowners really abusing poor farmers and tenant farmers, independent farmers, even given that, the tenant farmers identified up with the white plantation people and not with the you know, demoralized, traumatized slave. But so I think that characteristic goes back. But I tried to point out, wait a minute, your interests have not always, you know, have not coincided with the big plantation owners. And now in Louisiana, the plantations system is, in a sense, continued by oil.
And in oil, of course, is also the source of so much pollution as well, is it not?
Louisiana. It is. And not that many jobs. In my calculation, some 15% of all the jobs, at most, were associated directly or indirectly with oil. Many of those companies are based abroad, you know, British Petroleum in London, Royal Dutch Shells in The Hague, Sasol's in South Africa, and so on. And they are highly automated. And they sometimes import cheap Philippine pipe fitters. So So it's not a lot in it, actually, for poor whites. And this has to be brought out and could be in civil conversations across differences.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes then, Arlene Russell Hochschild, your book is extremely valuable in this election season. There's no question about it. It's must reading for anybody that's trying to understand this phenomenon. And we don't know the depth of it because it's not out of the question that Donald Trump could be elected. Mm. What, in the end of the day, do you think could break the spell? I know I've asked you that before, but in terms of healing on both sides, the illusions that liberals have has to be broken, and the false prophecy on the right has to be broken.
That's right. And I think on the liberal side, my book is a wake-up call. I think we've been asleep. The things are going on, quote, the other side, that we know not of, and they feel hurt by liberals in ways liberals don't intend and don't feel spoken to at all. It's something cultural beyond policies. It's policies, of course, but even the policies that you would think would help them are not couched in a way that they can culturally hear. So my book is really a call for reaching across empathically and having living room conversations and looking for common crossover issues. And that, I think, can help break the spell. But it's a wake-up call that we really need to talk to the people who are under the spell.
Well, thank you so much for joining us here today, Arlene Russell Hochschild.
My pleasure. Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Arlene Russell Hochschild. She's one of the most influential sociologists of her generation. She's the author of 9 books, including The Second Shift, The Time Bind, The Managed Heart, and The Outsourced Self. 3 of her books have been named as New York Times Notable Books of the Year, and her work appears in 16 languages. She's the winner of the Ulysses Medal and 5 honorary degrees, as well as the Guggenheim and Mellon Grants. And her latest book just out is Strangers in Their Own Land, Anger and Mourning on the American Right. And that was Background Briefing from September the 11th of 2016. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back with a program from November the 13th of 2016, speaking about how the press helped elect Donald Trump. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Jeff Jarvis, who's a professor and director of the Toe Knight Center for Entrepreneurial Journalism at the City University of New York, a national leader in the development of online news, blogging, the investigation of new business models for news, and the teaching of entrepreneurial journalism. He writes an influential blog, buzzmachine.com, and is the author of What Would Google Do? And Public Parts, How Sharing in the Digital Age Improves the Way We Work and Live, as well as the ebook Gutenberg the Geek. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jeff Jarvis.
Thank you so much.
And is it fair to blame the media for Donald Trump's victory?
It is important for media to accept the responsibility that it does indeed have. I think we failed the public in many ways. At a very simple level, I'll say this, that it is our job to inform the public. If the public is ill-informed, that's our fault. And I would argue that the election of Donald Trump is evidence of our failure. And I don't by that mean to say, I'm not trying to just accuse Donald Trump voters of being ill-informed, though I think our civil discourse was certainly ill-informed, civic discourse. But what I do mean to say is I think that we ill-serve many communities in this country with our mass media one-size-fits-all products, starting with African Americans, Latino Americans, LGBT Americans, and so on and so on. But included in that litany, I think we must now see, is conservative Americans, angry, white, underemployed Americans. We in liberal media, and I'm in media and I'm liberal, we in liberal media left a void and a vacuum that was too readily filled in by movements masquerading as media. That is to say, Fox News, Breitbart, Drudge. So if a conservative person doesn't believe that the New York Times understands their worldview and is empathetic to their concerns and doesn't trust the facts that they put out, where else are they going to go but to those outlets and worse that we left room for? So at many levels, I think we failed. And I don't want to see this discussion being about how we failed to predict the election. That horse race coverage is itself another failure because we concentrated constantly on trying to act like we knew what was going to happen rather than on informing the electorate about issues. We didn't do that.
Well, we also didn't get Donald Trump to release his taxes. We don't know who his creditors are, who may have leverage over him, particularly in foreign countries. But we certainly learned more than we needed to know about Hillary Clinton's email server.
Exactly. And the problem was also, I think we saw two phenomena of the current media business model come home to roost. One is clickbait, going for pure volume. Donald Trump is entertaining. And that was exploited to the point that Les Moonves at CBS and Jeff Zucker at CNN said Donald Trump may be bad for the nation, but good for their business. So this whole notion of clickbait, I think, came back to bite us in the rear. The second is the notion of false balance, that we are objective and we are balanced. Well, as my friend Jay Rosen at New York University, a journalism professor there, says, asymmetry fries the circuits of political journalism. That is to say, you have a case here where you don't have a Republican and a Democrat, a Mitt Romney and Barack Obama, who are kind of equivalent, both civilized, both experienced, but have very different views, and we report on that, and then we're done. In Trump versus Clinton, you had a wildly asymmetrical campaign, also in the primaries, and political journalism didn't know what to do with it. So every time they'd report on Trump grabbing a woman's private parts, they'd come back with email. Then Trump not revealing his taxes, email. Trump lying about this or that, email. The way to create balance was to normalize Trump and abnormalize Clinton and try to make them symmetrical, and they weren't, and that was a lie to the public.
Well, isn't, though, the whole idea of the liberal media something of a lie? At least it's a canard. I mean, my sense is that it is used in many ways to move the goalposts to the right. If you create a straw man and say that there's a liberal media and you need more conservative coverage, look what just happened with Facebook, where most people get their news, it turns out. The conservatives piled on. They clearly intimidated Mark Zuckerberg. Now he's got these ridiculous algorithms that print any stupid story, many of which are extremely misleading, and he doesn't seem to be taking responsibility for it.
Well, no, I'm going to disagree with you. I think that we have to admit that media are liberal. And again, I say this as a liberal member of media. I was out front about being a supporter of Hillary Clinton. I was in a room filled with many, many journalists on election night. We were scolded to show no reaction and no opinion. And the truth is, I knew that every single journalist in that room was mourning as this occurred. And we're not honest and transparent with our public. So I think we've got to start there, because who's going to trust us if we're not going to be honest? If we act as if we're above the public, as if we're better than the public, separate from the public, no, we're part of the public. Now, in terms of the Facebook argument, if you want to look at fake news that affected this election, I would start with the New York Times email story. That was fake news. I would start with the coverage of Hillary Clinton's foundation as if that was equivalent to Trump's. That was fake news. There was plenty of fake news from real media. Now, there was obviously patently fake, horrible stuff going around Facebook. But our reaction to that in media is to blame somebody else and blame Facebook and say, you clean it up. And I don't think we really want Facebook to become the censor of all. What should we do instead? We in media should have been feeding our own truthful memes into people's conversations, helping people who are reasonable and smart win these arguments and battles. Instead, once again, we left that void and vacuum to the cults And I think we have to take responsibility for that in liberal media. I also actually think we should invest in responsible, fact-based, conservative media to compete with the likes of Rupert Murdoch and Fox News, instead of just leaving that as the only place to brainwash people like my own parents.
But in terms, just to touch on the liberal media again, and I take your point, but on the other hand, my sense is that the word liberal, of course, is a dirty word. And in fact, it seems perfectly consistent with journalism to be liberal in the traditional sense of the word, to be open-minded, skeptical, not to have any particular dogma. It's the same kind of job requirement for an intelligence officer. You're not supposed to be gullible. You're supposed to be skeptical. You're supposed to inquire and not have any ideological baggage. And isn't that a job requirement in journalism, to be liberal and open-minded?
Absolutely. I mean, I work with The Guardian, which for many years had as its slogan, its goal, its mission, to be the world's leading liberal voice. And when questioned about that, Alan Rusbridger, the former editor, would say, well, then how do you do journalism? And he said, we do it by having intellectual honesty, by being unafraid to report the inconvenient truths. But it's certainly true that The Guardian has a worldview, and it comes from the left, and they're transparent about that. They're honest with their readers. The Telegraph in London, on the other hand, is equally transparent about its worldview from the right. And that enables people in the UK to triangulate the two. I think that's a positive ecosystem and architecture for news, and it exists across most of Europe, where you do have strong national voices. We don't have that here in the United States. And so there's no chance to triangulate. And, let's be honest, the right doesn't trust the New York Times. Can we fix that by adding one more conservative columnist, by doing one story better here and there? No, and I think that's fine. I think that we've got to also move past the model of mass media that said that one product could serve the entire country. I think we're learning on the Internet that communities do want to come together. Now then, yes, there's the danger of being an echo chamber in that, but responsible entities serving a community would present the other side in an argument decently, only to strengthen that community's view. And we don't have that. We don't have a healthy news ecosystem here.
Well, when you mentioned the New York Times, of course, we don't have any obligation in this country to the media owners to even present the news. The owners of television, many of them, I think, would prefer to have wall-to-wall commercials because that represents revenues. Programs represent costs. We only have good journalism, I think, largely by accident because Bill Paley had some kind of vision. And the New York Times, the family there, seems to have some sense of social responsibility. The people out here in Los Angeles that own the LA Times, the Chandlers for a while had that sense until they decided to sell out to a dreadful vulture capitalist. So, you know, we don't have a BBC that sets a journalistic standard. And the way that I understand this so-called balance, it largely came about because the owners of the newspapers decided, well, if we offend half our readers who are Democrats, or if we offend half our readers who are Republicans, let's just split it down the middle and say on the one hand and on the other hand. So it didn't come out of some great virtue of wanting to be fair and open-minded and balanced. It came out of a need not to alienate half of your readers.
Well, it also came out of television in the 50s, killing off the competitive newspapers in towns in the U.S., so you ended up with monopolies. And you're right, the business imperative of those monopolies was to be as big as possible, serve everybody, and so the mass media worldview took over in whole, and the mass media business model took over, and we're still trying to import that mass media business model onto the Internet, where we want reach and volume when we should be seeking relevance and value for our users, and we haven't begun to reinvent news media in this digital age. You know, one example of that is, I think this may sound trivial and horrible to your ears, but if we know that people are passing around memes on Facebook, and if those memes include false news, I think that we in responsible media should be creating memes with facts and truth in them, so that we can help arm the conversations of the reasonable people. But we don't. We say, no, we're still going to require you to come to our newspaper site, perhaps pay us, and read our 1,000-word article. And that's how our business operates, because we still have the old business model we used to have. We've got to reconsider journalism fundamentally.
So in terms of Hillary Clinton's recent statement, apparently in a call to donors, et cetera, commiserating, apparently,
She blamed her loss on James Comey, the director of the FBI's letter, the first letter, and then, of course, the retraction coming 2 days before. It did seem to objectively slow down her momentum. It certainly gave Donald Trump some spring in his step. He was kind of feeling demoralized, and then suddenly he hit the stump. And we know what happened. He narrowly won, although at this point it looks like she may even have had 2 million plus votes in the popular vote ahead, which is pretty extraordinary. The counting still continues, particularly in California, for another few weeks. So what do you make of that? Is it, my sense is that in a way, the way our politics and media relate is he who spins the press best wins the argument.
Well, there's an argument now that says that that he who gets the most memes wins the argument. And there may be some truth in that. Let's also define win and lose. Hillary Clinton, I went to the New York demonstration yesterday, and we shouted often that we were the majority. And we were. It's the odd system we have in the Electoral College that's created this reality. I think Comey had huge impact. I think he should be investigated under the Hatch Act. I think Clinton's right. And I also, but I've got to say this too. Standing in that demonstration, that huge demonstration in New York yesterday, you had a much larger one, I think, in L.A. yesterday. Number one, I hope that everyone in that shouting, chanting crowd did vote for Hillary Clinton, because that was the way to stop this from happening. And number two, I ask, where was that loud enthusiasm? Where were those shouts when we needed them before November 8th? Instead, we did have a media narrative that said, oh, nobody likes Clinton, nobody trusts Clinton, nobody's enthusiastic about Clinton. I was an enthusiastic Clinton voter. I went and canvassed and registered voters in Pennsylvania, the swing state, not enough, it seems. But I never saw myself in media. I never saw that represented. So the media narrative here to create some kind of tension was that Trump's the fun one and Clinton's the boring one and nobody cares. That's shallow and irresponsible, and I think that, too, had a huge impact on this election. I think it kept people from going out to vote.
Well, I was listening to NPR this morning, and it's all about healing and coming together, and that's a theme that is going around. And my sense is that people have every reason to be angry, and particularly if you consider the racism that Donald Trump poured forth with. And in fact, when he announced his run, he explicitly made racist statements against Mexicans. So you have either one or two conclusions. One, he is a racist, or two, which I think is even worse, that he decided as an absolute strategic move to inject racism into this election. And my sense is that people have every reason to be angry, and they should be angry, and there's no reason not to be angry and not to stay angry. And it's up to Donald Trump to heal the wounds that he created.
Yes, I have people coming to me on Twitter saying, "You know, give him a chance." This is a clean slate now. No, we well know Donald Trump's character, and either he is a racist or he's a cynic to use racism to his end to get elected. And either is bad. Either is awful. And you're absolutely right. He has to prove himself to us now. I'm not terribly optimistic, but the onus is on him.
And what about if it is proven that Comey is responsible? I mean, I don't know how you prove that. My sense is that the real smoking gun here is Trump's relationship to the Russians, which Comey apparently has been sitting on. You know, he's all too eager to put out bogus stuff about Hillary's emails, but he's been sitting on a lot of apparently stuff about possible links between the Kremlin and the Trump campaign.
At a tactical level, it is critical that we in journalism, put on more heat on the burner to make sure that we cover Trump and cover Comey and cover the story with the eye of the future elections and a more informed electorate in the future. At a longer-term way of thinking, I think what's also happening in our world is a challenge to the institutions, and we haven't begun to grapple with that. You know, if I get way up in the clouds, I'll argue that we're going through a Gutenberg-like moment with the internet, and that, you know, changed the map of the world literally. What if we're going through such a millennial moment now? We don't know where this is going to turn out. What's happening, I think, is that people are displaying great mistrust in institutions, government, politics, political parties, media, universities, and so on and so on. And So, and I think we have the authoritarians versus the Democrats, small d, going on as a war now within our country and around the world. So this is a bigger fight that's going on. So yes, we have to cover Comey. We have to find what was wrong there. We have to find the Russian relationships. We have to keep on dogging Trump for his taxes. It'll never happen. And on his foundation. We have to keep an absolute eagle eye on what his children do with the company and his involvement with the company. And that's all critical and vital. But I also think there's something bigger happening here.
Well, Jeff Jarvis, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you so much, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Jeff Jarvis, who's a professor and director of the Toe Knight Center for Entrepreneurial Journalism at the City University of New York. He's a national leader in the development of online news, blogging, the investigation of new business models for news, and the teaching of entrepreneurial journalism. And he writes an influential blog, BuzzMachine.com, and is the author of What Would Google Do? And Public Parts, How Sharing in the Digital Age Improves the Way We Work and Live, as well as the e-book Gutenberg the Geek. And that was Background Briefing from November the 13th. And we're going to take a brief station break. And we'll be back with a program broadcast on November the 24th about our plutocratic future under Donald Trump. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Stephen Schwartz, who's a distinguished consulting faculty at Saybrook University and a research associate of cognitive sciences at the Laboratories of Fundamental Research and the editor of the daily web publication SchwartzReport.net, where he identifies and analyzes trends that are affecting the future. His work has appeared in the Washington Post, Smithsonian, American Heritage, American History, Omni, Harper's, and Explore. And his latest book is The Eight Laws of Change, How to Be an Agent of Personal and Social Transformation. Welcome to Background Briefing, Stephen Schwartz.
Welcome to you, Ian.
Notwithstanding the political change that just took place in the United States, where Donald Trump appears to have looked upon the American government as an acquisition, how does it strike you?
It strikes me very much the same way. I think we have, you're beginning to hear about the rather obscure Article 1, Section 9, Clause 8 emoluments part of the Constitution, which I haven't heard anybody talk about in about 100 years, but which was extremely important to the founders, who, of course, had direct experience with what a corrupt administration was like. I find Trump two things. One is a master of manipulating the media. For instance, he's got them all off on the New York Times thing, you know, the meetings on, the meetings off. And the effect that had was to obfuscate the much deeper and much more fundamental issue is that we've elected a president who isn't so much a president as an emperor, in the way that Louis the 14th was the king of France. I mean, the conflicts of interest are so astonishing, and the idea that he's going to liquidate his business empire, I think, is absurd. His argument, oh, well, everybody knew that, but of course, everybody didn't really think, and the media was so inept that they didn't really get into the incredible conflicts of interest that exist, and that are going to exist, as far as I can see, for the next 4 years. We've never had anything quite like this in the United States.
But can you make the case that the election of Trump, because I recall he said on the stump how much he loves the undereducated, that this was a vote for Trump was the undereducated voting for Trump and the educated voting for Hillary Clinton. I think the statistics bear that out. She, needless to say, has now passed the 2 million point in the popular vote, being ahead of Trump, and she may end up being at 2.5 to 3 million ahead by the end of the counting.
Yeah.
So we have this extraordinary situation where the emperor and the oligarchs like the Koch brothers and this new oligarch as the head of education, Betsy DeVos, it's almost as if unwittingly the white working class in this country have rewarded the oligarchs who are going to continue to dumb them down so that the people in America more and more will be voting for the interests of the oligarchs against their own interests.
Yes, I think that's very true. I just, I think the thing that we're not talking about is that it isn't that the Democratic elites don't understand the flyover part of America. I think it's that the flyover part of America has become so ignorant of the actual issues, and this arises in large measure because of the capture of Christianity by a kind of theocratic rightist fundamentalism. That the difficulty is that these people that voted for Trump do not recognize that he is not going to advance their interests. The coal mines are not coming back. The you know, the steel industry is not coming back. That we are moving, whether the United States is moving, the rest of the world is moving out of the carbon energy era. India has now made a commitment they want to be entirely non-carbon by 2030. Much of Europe, France, Holland, Scandinavian countries are talking about having all electric vehicles on their roads and, in fact, passing laws about this by 2030, 2035. That's only 14 years, you know, 20 years away. The one bright spot is that we are going to go out of the carbon energy era willy-nilly, whether the United States oil interests and other oil interests continue to push this. So I think that is positive news and ought to be a cause for celebration and Thanksgiving. I really see this vote as a decision by a significant percentage of the American electorate, not the majority, and as you pointed out, but a significant percentage that is essentially responding to the four major trends that I think are shaping the world today. And very few people are talking about them. You see little bits and pieces, but the four trends that I think are really important and I think we should consider very seriously at Thanksgiving are that for the first time in 500 years, being born white will not confer privilege. That's the first one. The second one is that for the first time in living memory and way beyond, actually probably more than thousands of years, being born white and male will not confer dominance. The third is that Western Caucasian cultural values are not going to run the world. And the fourth is that we are seeing the rise of neo-feudalism in the transfer of power from nation states to multinational corporations, which essentially are going to function like baronies and duchies in the medieval period, and that what we're going to end up with is a tiny group of people who own most of the wealth. Right now, 10% of the world owns 89% of all the world's wealth, and a modest middle class made up mostly of professional people, lawyers, doctors, engineers, and then a huge peasantry that are deliberately kept ignorant and pliable, and for whom easy non-fact-based beliefs will be emphasized. That I think is the major problem. Is not that the flyover Americans weren't heard. It's that they do not realize the forces that are at work that are negatively affecting their own lives.
Well, apropos the education issue that we were just talking about, isn't it true that the governor of Michigan, where Betsy DeVos comes from,
exactly.
What did he argue in the test meeting the other day?
You know, this is almost, this is, I mean, it's almost, I mean, it's mind-boggling. Yes, Governor Rick Schneider, governor of Michigan, is basically arguing in court that children do not have a fundamental right to literacy. That's what his attorneys are saying. There's a lawsuit that's pending. About 47% of the Detroit children are either illiterate or semi-literate. And so their lawsuits in the public about public schools not really teaching kids to proper literacy. And the argument that his attorneys are making in the court are that there is no fundamental right to being literate, and that the government has no fundamental responsibility for educating children. It's precisely the opposite of what all of America has had as a fundamental tradition for hundreds of years.
Well, on the other point that you just made, though, about a new kind of global medieval kind of duchies of oligarchs and multinational corporations ruling the world with a very small professional middle class and then a vast underclass globally, that does seem to be a real trend. But the more alarming statistic is that Oxfam reported recently that half of the world's wealth is controlled by only 85 families.
Yes, that's right. That's the point I'm making. I mean, we are, you know, in the medieval period, the peasantry was land-based because wealth was principally land-based at that time. And so wealthy people owned large tracts of land, and the peasantry either owned just little strips in their villages and where they could grow garden stuff, but they worked as villeins for their lords. Well, we don't have that. That's not the kind of wealth we have now. This is a different thing. But what we are creating is a large underclass of people who may at best own a car and maybe a modest house. I mean, 62% of Americans don't have have $1,000 or less in savings. So we have a huge number of people who have very, very little assets, and a very tiny group of people who control us, as I said, 10% of the population of the world owns 89% of the wealth. And if you break it down to the 1%, it gets even more distorted, so that you have a few people. I mean, I just read a paper that proposed that eventually most of the world's assets will be owned by about 4,000 people, and everybody else will sort of either be in service to that or will just be this part of this underclass. And you don't see anybody in the media talking about this.
Well, let's see what we can do or what people can do to reverse that. Obviously, it's a massive task. However, I just learned recently, for example, when you mentioned that the jobs in steel are not going to come back to Youngstown. Back during the Carter administration, the writing was on the wall about the erosion of the industrial base of the United States, and there was an effort underway to create worker-owned cooperatives like the Spanish Madragon Cooperative.
Yes.
In Youngstown. In other words, the workers could take over the steel plants, and of course the steel companies weighed in against Carter. But there seems to be, across the board, real possibilities and some very, very optimistic examples of rural state banks, for example, lots of co-ops, worker-owned industries and co-ops developing. That seems to me to be, particularly with the Spanish example being so extraordinary, that seems to be a possible way to fight against this oligarchical trend.
Yes, I think you're absolutely right, Ian. I mean, as I look at it, I think what we're going to see is a transfer from from the federal level down to the local level, not even the state level, although maybe in some cases. I mean, for one thing, if you've noticed, I'm sure you have, the secession movement, I don't think it's going to succeed, but as an expression of social intention, the Washington, Oregon, California drive to because these cultures are prospering much more than the red value states. I mean, if you look at comparisons between red value states and blue value states, you can see without exception that the blue value states always do better. And the reason is, and I've been looking at this now for 16 years, and I guess this is the good news of Thanksgiving, is that social programs which are designed with their first priority being the increase of well-being inevitably are cheaper, more efficient, more effective, easier to implement, more productive, nicer to live under, and longer lasting than social programs which are designed to enrich just small groups and which produce a decrease or degradation in well-being, and that the way you create well-being is at the local, individual and local level. I mean, I wrote the 8 Laws of Change specifically in anticipation of this election because I saw these trends occurring, and as dark as it may seem, maybe on Thanksgiving it would be a good thing to focus on the fact that there is no power on earth more powerful than collective human intention. When a mass of people hold to a nonviolent, wellness-oriented program, whether it's civil rights or exploitation of resources or anything else, inevitably, because well-being is the first priority, you do better. And if you look across not only between states like Sam Brownback's Kansas and Jerry Brown's California, or you look at between countries like Norway and Russia, for instance, you can see very clearly that where well-being and local activity is the focus, that you get a much better, cheaper, more efficient, more productive outcome. And so I hope that everybody, as they give thanks on Thanksgiving, will make a commitment to that from the, say, this Thanksgiving forward, that every choice they make, the toilet paper they buy, the breakfast cereal they buy, that they will always make a point of choosing that option which is the most life-affirming and compassionate. And if we do that, we will be able to right our ship and to produce a more wellness-oriented future, because the alternative is very bleak indeed.
Well, indeed. Don't buy brawny paper products, because you're enriching the Koch brothers. I thank you for joining us, Stephen Schwartz.
Absolutely. A pleasure to talk to you.
And again, I've been speaking with Stephen Schwartz, who's a distinguished consulting faculty at Saybrook University and a research associate of cognitive sciences at the Laboratories of Fundamental Research and the editor of the daily web publication schwartzreport.net. This has been Background Briefing, a special New Year's Day edition. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me and scroll down the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow. In the meantime, have a very happy new year. Bye for now.